Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this June 2010 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening's scientific bacchanalia, Jim Campanella. Let's get started. We have lots to do in so little time. Ah, wow. I'm not even sure how to start this first story. I was simply beyond words when I found out about it. It was sent to me by Julio Flavio Morales Marchini, MD, PhD, and listener from Harvard. Julio wanted to make sure I attributed his original finding of the story to Boing Boing, but I have not seen that posting. As Julio said, the story sounds like something out of a parallel world. I thought I'd comment about that, and I figure that if this is from a parallel world, then it must be from the one in the original Star Trek episode Mirror Mirror. That's the one where evil Spock has the goatee and Kirk has a live-in courtesan in his quarters. Sulu is a sadistic homosexual and the crew women's miniskirts got even shorter, if that's possible. So this story is about a report in the Journal of the Indian Medical Association from December 2009. A couple of things before we go down the rabbit hole. First, the Journal of the Indian Medical Association is actually respected, and I still can't believe that they published this. Second, the article is real. The abstract could be found in the online database Medline until last week, when apparently someone with an even lower tolerance for the horrible than me pulled it out. Third, I have tried without luck to get a copy of the actual article, but I've been unsuccessful. Therefore, as horrible as the story sounds when I talk about it, it may simply be a very badly written abstract. JIMA publishes exclusively in English, and that is certainly not the first language of most Indian physicians. Okay, down the rabbit hole then. The story by Drs. Hussain, Rizvi, and Usmani is entitled High Frequency Ultrasound Torturer, and yes, that is what the article is about. Let me read the abstract, which will put it all in context and make you realize why even the abstract was pulled from the official listing. Oh, and any of you who know me realize I simply can't just read the abstract. It has to be done with a certain amount of aplomb. Quote, "The discernible aim of torture, as everyone believes, and rightly so, is to destroy the personality of an individual in a way that would render his compliance in the future. But to destroy a personality is easier said than done. It requires long sessions of detention and torture. The torturers risk themselves getting exposed. The human rights groups are active all around the world. Ultimately, the personality may not be destroyed, much to the chagrin of the torturers, and an unexpected, resilient rebounding may take place. Therefore, with the repertoire of modern knowledge, the strategy may well change in the 21st century. Discreet methods may be employed to selectively destroy areas of the brain by high dosage and high frequency ultrasound. It is completely a non-invasive technique that does not leave its fingerprint for painful later denials of subordination. Nevertheless, the personality will change from rightful aggression to slavish submission. The aim of this article is to put forward the theoretical perspective and co-founded projection of the darker, menacing side of ultrasound technology so that future generations can be saved from the sin of omission." Unquote. That last sentence rings in my head. Sin of omission? Given the terrible English, did they mean the sin of omission of not using sonic torture, or using sonic torture? It's entirely unclear to me what they're proposing. Again, is this a polemic against sonic torture, or is it justifying sonic torture as a way to create an efficient, non-invasive technique that leaves no scars for Amnesty International to find? I am flummoxed. I did some digging, and Drs. Hussain, Rizvi, and Usmani are all respected physicians from the Department of Forensic Medicine in the Medical College of Aligarh Muslim University. They wrote an article critical of the press for supporting Lorena Bobbitt in 2004, and another paper in 2002, citing that epileptics in India were badly treated and traditionally discriminated against, and proposing societal changes. And they wrote another article in 1996 on dowry cannibalism. Oh, you'll love this one. The term dowry cannibalism describes a unique case where the motive for cannibalism was the non-fulfillment of a husband's dowry demands from his wife. The husband was accused by the wife of regularly using a syringe to withdraw blood from her with the intent of causing her death and drinking it. These guys sound like they should have a TV show. Okay, much as I want to believe that these guys support sonic torture, they simply don't sound like the kind of people who would do that. I go back to my mangled English hypothesis. Over the years, I have reviewed several scientific papers from researchers in India, and almost universally they had difficulties with English. I want to give these guys the benefit of the doubt because the alternative is just, well, sad. I've tried to contact the author of the paper to get a copy of the full article and perhaps an explanation or justification for it. Perhaps I'll have an update on this seriously weird topic next month if these guys ever deign to answer me. The next story is a bit timely because I just discussed neuropharmacologic agents with my introductory biology class yesterday. We talked about how stimulants like cocaine and amphetamines mimic neurotransmitters like acetylcholine and cause your whole nervous system to be pushed into high gear. We, of course, discuss the many drawbacks of abusing these chemicals. Well, a paper just published in the Journal of Experimental Biology this month from Dr. Ken Lukowiak's lab at the University of Calgary suggests that heavy methamphetamine use may not be all bad, if you're a snail. Let me explain. In humans, methamphetamine is highly addictive. It seduces victims by increasing self-esteem, sexual pleasure, and inducing euphoria. It's strange, but amphetamines also seem to enhance memory. As the authors write, quote, "In addiction, we talk about the drug memory as a pathological memory. It is so potent as to not be easily forgotten," unquote. Since this pathological memory was induced by meth use, the authors wondered whether the user's regular memory was altered as well. This seems like an odd idea given the image of most meth addicts, which does not exactly bring to mind mental geniuses, but it's an interesting premise. Lukowiak and his group used pond snails to examine the question of memory enhancement and methamphetamine. Snails keep their memories about when to breathe through their breathing tubes in a simple three-neuron network. Now, that is much simpler than the massive circuits that hold human memories. The researchers decided to find out whether a dose of meth could improve the snail's memory. Snails breathe through their skins when oxygen levels are high, but when oxygen levels start to drop, the snails extend their breathing tubes above the water's surface to supplement the supply of oxygen. Since the drug crosses the snail's skin, the team immersed the snails in deoxygenated pond water spiked with meth and watched to see how it affected their breathing. The snails stopped raising their breathing tubes at between 1 and 3 micromoles per liter of methamphetamine. After finding a dose that altered the snail's behavior, the team then began testing its effects on the mollusk's long-term memory. They trained the snails to remember to keep their breathing tubes closed when oxygen levels were low by poking them with a stick every time they tried to open them. High tech, huh? They gave the snails 2 training sessions separated by an hour. They did this knowing that the snails would remember this for about 24 hours. They tested the snails in deoxygenated pond water 24 hours later, and they were surprised to see that the snails seemed to have no recollection of their training. They popped their breathing tubes above the water's surface, and they got stuck with the stick again. Oddly enough, it turned out that to demonstrate that the snails did remember, the researchers had to reproduce the original conditions exactly. When they reintroduced the methamphetamine into the test water, the snails suddenly remembered to keep their breathing tubes closed. This result is interesting because it could explain why it's so hard for human addicts to kick the habit when returning to old haunts that trigger addiction memory. They then tested the snails to determine whether meth could improve their memories. First, they immersed the snails in meth-laced pond water. Then they moved them into regular deoxygenated pond water and gave them a training session that the snails would only be able to recall for a few hours. In theory, the snails should have forgotten their training 24 hours later, but would the meth improve the snails' memory so that they would remember to keep their breathing tubes closed a day later? It did. A dose of meth prior to training improved the snails' memory, allowing them to recall a lesson that should have been long forgotten. And when the team tested whether they could mask the meth memory with another memory, they found that the meth memory was much stronger and harder to mask. The conclusion to all this drug testing? Well, memories formed under the influence of meth seem to be harder to forget, possibly because the drug disrupts the mechanisms of forgetting. Since some forms of ADD treatment seem to have methamphetamine-like properties, I am wondering whether the abuse of these drugs as a study aid by some high schoolers is not justified in some weird way. Maybe those ADD medications really do help to retain memories. I will present the next story quickly. It's interesting to me since I have young kids, but it may not come onto the radar at all of most people who don't have kids or don't have kids that are quite as young anymore as mine. Boston College psychologist Dr. James Russell presented this finding at the May 28th Association for Psychological Science annual meeting. Russell has evidence that children less than age 5 do not recognize disgust on adult faces. Until age 5, children see disgust as just another form of anger. Russell regards these new results as consistent with his controversial rejection of an influential theory that 6 emotions are built into humans from birth: happiness, sadness, anger, fear, surprise, and disgust, and that each of these appears as a distinctive facial expression displayed by people everywhere. Instead, Russell proposes that 2 core feeling dimensions, high arousal and low arousal, and positive reaction to negative reaction, provide the building blocks for emotions that get elaborated in each culture. Russell's team has previously found that a majority of children misidentify feelings expressed in adults' facial expressions. Even at age 14, a substantial minority still errs on this task, and you fans out there of the Fox TV show Lied to Me are probably finding this story fascinating at about this point. In 2 new experiments, Russell observed that youngsters often know the meanings of words for emotions before they can comprehend the meanings of the facial expressions that go with them. The researchers studied nearly 600 children aged 2 to 7. Kids viewed images on a computer screen of adults displaying the 6 basic emotional expressions. The kids' task was to assign faces to boxes at the bottom of the screen that had been designated for specific emotions. At age 2, children's accuracy was limited to putting happy faces in a happy box. Toddlers treated all negative emotional expressions as just being plain angry. Shortly after age 3, an appreciation of sad faces emerged, and about a year later, kids could accurately identify angry faces and had generally stopped putting faces with other negative expressions into the angry box. Correct designations of other facial expressions soon followed, with comprehension of disgusted faces finally appearing last. Now, other psychological researchers point out that even though young children may not be able to identify disgust on somebody's face, they can still understand the concept of disgust through their understanding of things that are gross or icky. Now, I can attest to that. My daughter certainly understands gross, and she does not hesitate to inform us of her disgust at our selections of food at most mealtimes. Onwards and upwards. Dr. Denise Chen, a psychologist at Rice University, studied 20 heterosexual couples that had been living together, either married or unmarried, for 1 to 7 years. She presented her data on these couples at the May 29th Association for Psychological Sciences annual convention. What Chen studied was whether partners could tell what emotions the other was feeling simply through smell. Yes, as in, "Good morning, dear. Oh my, but you smell happy today." Chen used underarm pads to collect sweat from participants as they watched videos that induced self-reported happiness, fear, sexual arousal, or neutral feelings. Volunteers then sniffed odors from 4 jars containing sweat from either the person's partner or a stranger of the opposite sex. The participants tried to identify one smell that came from a person experiencing a particular feeling, such as happiness. One jar contained sweat collected during an emotional video, and the rest contained sweat collected during a quote-unquote neutral video. Overall, participants detected specific emotions from their partner's body odor nearly two-thirds of the time. Couples that had lived together the longest did best at identifying each other's emotional odors, Chen reported. Accuracy fell to about 50% for opposite-sex strangers. Make of this odd story what you will, but it certainly brings to bear evidence for that old literary saw of smelling fear. Okay, a couple more stories before we finish up for the evening. First, Dr. Douglas Theobald, a biochemist at Brandeis University, published a statistical study in the journal Nature 2 weeks ago, which shows evidence that all life on Earth came from a single ancestor. That is right. We are all literally related to every other living thing on Earth from a single, original, ancient organism. This is an important result because some scientists have proposed that multiple primordial life forms could have tossed their genetic material into life's mix and created a web rather than a tree of life. For his analysis, Theobald selected 23 proteins that are found across the taxonomic spectrum, but have structures that differ from one species to another. He looked at those proteins in 12 different species, four each from the bacterial, archaeal, and eukaryotic domains of life. Then he performed computer simulations to evaluate how likely the various evolutionary scenarios were to produce the observed array of proteins. He found that scenarios featuring a universal common ancestor won hands down against even the best performing multi-ancestor models. Theobald says, quote, "The universal common ancestor models didn't just explain the data better, they were also the simplest, so they won on both counts." Theobald's study did not address how many times life may have arisen on Earth. Life could have originated a whole bunch of times, but his model study suggests that only one of those primordial events yielded the present array of organisms living today. The final story of the evening is a bisphenol update. If you have been a regular listener over the last few months, you know that I have talked about the plastic additive bisphenol A several times and its negative effects on human and animal physiology. New laboratory studies in Japan indicate that the fluorinated twin of BPA, called bisphenol AF or BPAF, may be even more potent than BPA in altering the effects of steroid hormones such as estrogens on the body. Dr. Yasuyuki Shimohigashi of Kyushu University reported April 28th in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives that BPAF, which is an ingredient of hard plastics, may be BPA's nastier evil twin. The chemical's fluorine atoms appear to give it a strong affinity for the two best-studied estrogen receptors, estrogen receptor alpha and estrogen receptor beta. Indeed, the fluorines bind to the alpha receptor about 20 times more effectively than BPA does, and to the beta receptor almost 50 times more effectively. After binding, BPAF activates the alpha receptor just like the body's own estrogen would. The big surprise, Shimohigashi says, was finding that despite BPAF's even stronger affinity for the beta receptor, it elicited no activity from there. It just blocked it up like a big molecular dud. In so doing, it also blocks the receptor's access to the body's own estrogen, preventing it from unlocking any of the myriad operations normally controlled via that important receptor. And here is the true horror of the story. Where alpha receptors promote reproductive cancers, the beta receptors tend to inhibit cancer development and foster health in a whole range of issues. The two receptors are kind of like yin and yang, and here's the problem. Simplistically speaking, the alpha receptor is the bad guy and the beta is the good one. Generally, their actions tend to balance each other. And that's what appears to make BPAF such a double-edged sword. By increasing alpha receptor activity and then shutting down the beta receptor's countervailing functions, BPAF appears to shift endocrine action toward even greater toxicity. Let me just put it this way. In short, BPAF is not good for people or animals. Oh, and to make you feel even better, little is known about the quantity of BPAF produced each year in the world, or even the likely human exposures. I am just speechless at this, and I hope that someone figures out something to do about this very soon. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, watch out for Indian doctors with sonic screwdrivers, and I hope I have inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.